From the American Tobacco Historic District, this is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Well, if you haven't sat down yet with your shoebox of receipts, sharp pencil, and calculator, you're about to. Your taxes are due April 15th. Actually, this year, because the 15th is on a Saturday, you have until the 17th. But the Ides of April has long been a point of consternation and discussion for Americans. Tax reform has been part of the platform of every presidential candidate over the last four elections, and there's a logic to that call. People want to know what they're spending on and whether they're getting their money's worth for all of the spending we do and whether there's a better way to collect and distribute tax money. So today on The State of Things, we'll have a conversation that you're having, probably, taxes. What do they pay for? What should they pay for? Who decides? Give us a call at 877-962-9862 to tell us whether you think there's a better way, how much public service should be public service, how much should be private, and whether there are things that our money should never go for in the public arena. 877-962-9862, SOT at WUNC.org. With us in the studio today are three people who ought to know a thing or two about taxes. Mike Munger is an economist and chair of the Political Science Department at Duke University. Mike, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
William Turnure is a professor of law who teaches tax law at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill School of Law. William Turnure, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm honored to be here.
And Roy Cordato is vice president for research and a resident scholar at the John Locke Foundation in Raleigh. Roy Cordato, welcome to the program.
Thanks.
We are taking your calls at 877-962-9862. I'll start with all of you. And Mike Munger, you first. Why do we pay taxes? What's the theory here?
Oliver Wendell Holmes said that taxes are what we pay for a civilized society. I guess I respond with Arthur Godfrey's riposte. He said, I'm proud to be paying taxes in the United States, but I'd be almost as proud for half as much money. the reason that we pay taxes is that we all agree that we need government. We all agree that we need government services. We may disagree quite a bit about what those services are, and I think the reason that a lot of people at this time of year may have some questions is you look at that amount, it's pretty big, and you think of all the things over the past year that you might have done differently from what our government has done.
Roy Cordato with the John Locke Foundation, I would guess that you could be at least half as proud as far as the amount of government service and the amount of money that goes for public services in this country.
Sure. I think my answer to that question would be first and foremost is people pay taxes because if they don't, they go to jail. I can only reiterate what Mike said, is that ultimately we pay taxes to support the government. And we all have varying views to the extent to which we get our money's worth and how much of what we have should go to the government.
Well, William Turnure, we think about these government services, basic services, you know, the bedrock services like police and fire protection. That's something we can't do for ourselves. So we all say, well, let's put it into the kitty and we'll buy this service for everybody. But it really wasn't always that way, was it?
No, it really wasn't. I think one of the more interesting stories is about what went on in colonial Philadelphia. People there, of course, we had no municipal fire departments. They used to buy fire insurance, and there were a variety of different companies and no telephones. And so consequently, somebody's house would start on fire, and the companies would just see smoke rising. They'd all rush off to it, and they'd arrive at your house, and you'd have a little symbol on the front of your house, a pine tree or some crossed hands or whatever, that showed what company you were insured with. Lo and behold, if you had none, they'd start negotiating with you. Or if another fire company arrived there first, they'd start negotiating with you. And that's certainly, talk about negotiating under duress, all right? So Benjamin Franklin came up with the idea of creating a municipal fire department and putting all of that to an end. And I think we've pretty much done that, although there are a few municipalities, I think, that have private fire services.
I just want to go back over this because it shocked me to hear this, that insurance companies in colonial America were providing fire protection. So you either had insurance or you didn't. And if you did, you had a symbol in front of your house.
Yes.
And all these insurance company fire departments.
Of course, it was in their best interest to put your fire out when they arrived
really
there.
Really quick.
Yeah, really quick, because it was their insurance dollars that were going up, you might say.
Well, so Roy Cordato, let's think about that. Do we get better fire service if people are if it's insurance companies providing this service? And you know, would we be smart to go back to that kind of a system? What's wrong with that?
Actually, I don't think there's anything wrong with it. I, to be quite frank, I don't know whether we would get better service. One thing he pointed out is it clearly is in the interest of the insurance company to get that fire out as quickly as possible because they have a a financial interest in whether your house goes up in smoke or not, where your typical fireman doesn't, although there's pride involved and they like to do their job well. And so whether we would be better off under one system or the other, I don't know. But to be quite frank, I mean, it's something worth looking at.
Right. And Mike Munger, this is the core question that we ask in public policy, is whether or not private industry can do this better, and whether the government, how do we make the decision about when the public is best served through public policy, through a public fire department, and whether or not private industry would do it better, faster, and cheaper?
Well, one of the key questions we always have to face is what activities should be in the public sector and what should be in the private sector. I think it's important to recognize that what happens is there's usually a transformation. If we all agree that there's a program that we think helps a certain segment of the population, it's irresistible to politicians to expand that group and to expand it towards the middle class. So that's where political power lies, is at the center of the distribution of voter preferences. So if we have something that helps poor people, inevitably it's going to be expanded to serve the middle class. It's going to get more and more expensive, but middle class people are going to benefit. And so one question is, should it be public or private? And the other is, how can we make the money stick at the population that we think needs to be served by this program?
Because as we've pointed out, you can have every level of service, including fire protection and safety, done at the private level. And I guess you get to the question of whether or not if I let my house burn, then the house next door burns and the whole city goes down. But that becomes a separate question.
It's Chicago.
So let's take a look at a little bit about in the tax code itself and how the tax code, Professor Turnier, actually changes social policy. You heard Mike Munger talk about programs aimed perhaps at the low end of the economic scale, but ultimately we have to benefit the middle, because it's voter preference politically that's going to keep this program afloat.
That's indeed the case, and I think a good example of that might be our tuition tax credits that a number of people are probably familiar with, that you have that HOPE scholarship credit, where people get 100% credit for the first $1,000 spent, and then 50% for the next $1,000 on the first 2 years of higher education, and then lifetime learning credit, where you can get up to 20%. It's kind of curious, I think, when you look at things like that. It's money that we don't collect, that we allow individuals to keep themselves, and rather than paying the taxes they would have paid, and then turn them over to a higher education institution, be it state or be it private. Other countries, however, European countries, they don't have something like this. They typically provide a lot of support for their higher education, much more than we do. The failure to collect, I think, also can be, on a broad base, can be viewed as a type of support. It's, however, creates a more flexible environment in which an individual, for example, has an opportunity to use that tax credit and go to Duke or to go to Guilford College or something like that, or go to UNC.
Well, Roy Cordato at the John Locke Foundation, should government be in the business of directing resources one way or another, directing resources to higher education by collecting less in tax money?
Well, the short answer to that is no. The state, what the state should do is try to get the tax system out of the way of productive activity. And by targeting tax breaks and so on in order to affect the distribution of resources, they are essentially using the tax system to centrally plan the economy. This is done all the time with what's called economic development policy, where corporations, that most recently, you know, Dell Computers, gets huge tax breaks to set up shop in a certain area of North Carolina. Well, this is really state central planning of the economy. And what the state should do in terms of the tax code is to get it out of the way, take away tax biases against saving and investment, which we have, tax biases against capital accumulation, even tax biases against against education, because education to a large extent is an investment, and in fact investment is penalized.
If you remove all these biases, Roy, I'll stay with you for a minute. Who benefits?
I think everyone does. I think the economy grows, and what you and with without penalizing saving and investment, what you get is a faster growing economy. And you know, it might sound like a cliche, but the rising tide lifts all boats.
Well, does it? Mike Munger, economist, chairman of the Political Science Department. We've seen in recent years, anyway, that a rising tide may raise all boats, but it also has created a growing rift between the wealthy and the less wealthy. Does everybody benefit when something we call the economy improves, especially at the lower end of the economic scale?
Sure, everybody benefits. Everybody doesn't benefit to the same extent, and not everybody benefits to the same extent from the tax system. If deductions, after all, only help you if you make income. So you can have very lavish deductions, and it can only possibly help people who make income. The more income you have, the more deductions help. Let me take a brief step back for a second. There's two questions that we have to ask ourselves. First is, who owns this income? Who owns this economic activity? Is it ours, or does it belong to the government in a kind of partnership? The second is, who is better able to make choices regarding how it is to be spent? So if we look at that first one, if I think this money is mine and the government's taking it, then I may have a different perspective. Then I think this is something where the government, it's created in partnership with the society, and I'm going to get to keep some of it.
We will explore those questions and others in more detail as we look at tax time and the tax man today. Mike Munger, economist at Duke, William Turnure, who teaches tax law at UNC School of Law, and Roy Cordato from the John Locke Foundation. Your phone calls as well, 877-962-9862. We tax too much, too little? Is it going to the right places? 877-962-9862. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. We're talking today about taxes, that time of year again. With us is Mike Munger, an economist and chair of the Political Science Department at Duke University. William Turnure is a professor of law who teaches tax law at the University of North Carolina Chapel Hill School of Law. Roy Cordato is the vice president for research and a resident scholar at the John Locke Foundation in Raleigh. And we're taking your calls at 877-962-9862, emails at sot@wunc.org. Before the break, we're talking about the two big questions. Number one, probably the biggest question, whose money it is? Is it? I earned this money fair and square. This is my dough. Why should any of it go to public policy? Doesn't the market decide where it should go, and then everybody's happy? Roy Cordato.
Well, certainly I think if you earn it, it's yours. And by the way, the North Carolina State Constitution agrees with me. Article 1 of the State Constitution says not only do we are we all born with endowed right to life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, but also to the fruits of our labor. And so this is a right in North Carolina. We own the fruits of our labor. So I happen to agree with that, even if it wasn't in our state constitution. I think that we all have a natural right to our bodies, ourselves, and what we produce, and our income is that. So starting with that premise, We have to then move on to say, well, what is the justification for the state and for state coercion to take what is inherently mine? I think if we go beyond that, we face some very strange situations that what is mine isn't mine. I share it equally with everyone else. Say there's 100 million people in the country. Every person has 100 millionth claim on my income, or maybe 50% of the people have a claim on 100% of my income. That would be slavery. You get into some very strange situations if you don't assume.
Should there be any taxes, though? Should there be a tax code and any kind of taxation? And then should there be any public spending?
Well, if you're asking me, am I an anarchist? The question is no.
Well, you can have law and order, but not necessarily public spending.
Well, yeah. And there's plenty of people who debate that issue, and I'm not a good one to do that. So do I believe that there should be a state in which that protects private property and people's right to trade and to make contracts and provide certain basic services? The answer is yes.
William Turnure, there are ways that the tax code does affect how much I own. When we talk about I earned it, there are things in the code that subtly and things in law that subtly affect who earns what that protect or favor certain kinds of investment. And if it's an investment provision, it means you've got money to invest. Talk a little bit about the ways the tax code can subtly have an impact on the income you have to dispose of.
Well, it can do that in a number of ways. I think what in designing a tax system, one thing that one wants to do ideally is to keep marginal rates down as much as possible.
So when you talk about a marginal rate,
well,
what do you mean?
The rate at the top, all right, that's going to distort your behavior. I mean, you look at progressive rates and you might start at 15, 25, 30%, and then that's what you're most concerned about. Any deduction you get will be affected by that sort of decision. So you want to keep them down, and at the same time, you want to, because you'll keep down the distortion, you want to cut down on providing preferential rates. For example, on capital gains, we give them 15%. And so people now tend to skew their activity toward getting capital gains rather than investing in a business that might produce ordinary income. The best thing that we had actually was probably back after the 1986 Reform Act, in which we had relatively low rates. Top rate was 28%, and we had no differential between capital gains and other income. Right now, your dividends will get 15%. Your interest will get, you know, a higher rate, maybe as much as 35%. And so that distorts my decision as to whether I'll buy a bond or I'll buy a preferred stock. Shouldn't be that
way. We're taking your calls at 877-962-9862 as we talk about taxes today. Dean is on the line from Raleigh. Hello, Dean.
Hi. Thank you. I think the principle involved in what the government should do relates to the profit motive, and they should not outsource services where profit is involved. Now, for instance, parking in Raleigh. We've outsourced that to a company that wants to make a profit, and so we get distortions. And another example is healthcare, in which that's all done in the private sector when, once again, the motive is profit and not providing the service.
All right. Thank you, Dean.
Those are the only sorts of services you can outsource, is where profit or some kind of private gain is what's involved. It is an interesting question, though. How much should be outsourced, and then what sort of control do you have over it? Should we have private prisons? It would be quite possible to say, we'll outsource prisons. There, the level of coercion that's provided is so high that you might think not. Parking, you can just, if the company does a bad job, fire them and get somebody else. The profit motive ought to be enough. It's been mismanaged, but I don't think you can blame the profit motive.
Let's talk a little bit about how the United States is taxed compared to other countries. And Professor Tournier, now that, you know, we all feel like, especially this time of year, we're paying way too much. How do we as Americans compare to the rest of the developed world?
I know this is going to come to as a shock to a lot of people, but we're actually a relatively lowly taxed country. In the 30 countries that make up the OECD, which is an organization of democracies with market-based economies, we come 26th. The only countries that are less than us are Turkey, Korea, Japan, and Mexico. And I don't think two of those countries probably are providing services at the level that we would expect. And Japan is really an outlier because their constitution forbids them from having anything other than a limited military for defensive purposes. If we were to have a military at the level Japan had, we'd probably be below Japan. So we're not really very heavily taxed.
Well, Roy Cordato, on the theory that the higher the tax rate, the worse you do economically, we should be doing a whole lot better than the rest of Europe based on that.
And we are.
In what way?
Our unemployment rate is much lower than virtually everybody in Europe. I mean, Europe's growth is anemic compared to the United States. We have probably, to compare us to Europe economic growth-wise, it's not even close.
There's 8 to 10% unemployment rates compared to 4 or 5 in the United States. And the growth rate, you have kind of index number problem. Our economy is so large.
It's just hard to compare.
Mm-hmm.
Do you compare us to the entire economic union, or European Union? Is that a smart thing to do? And I would think then by comparison, do we do any better that way?
Well, the American tax system is hard because our taxes are complex and they're charged at multiple levels. So if you look at the total level of taxes, federal income taxes have gone down, but state income taxes and other taxes have had to go up to compensate. Interestingly, North Carolina is a relatively high tax state compared to other states. It's one of the very highest in the South. There's only six states with higher tax rates
States in the South or overall?
Six states in the United States with higher income tax rates. Now, it's difficult because you some of that's how you calculate the base and how you calculate the rate. You know, what do you charge the tax on? But North Carolina is a relatively high tax state, and I think that surprises a lot of people. But that's only compared to other U.S. states.
You know, I believe, though, the real problem with that is whether you combine the local tax burden, too. I lived in New Jersey. We had horrendous property taxes and relatively low taxes at the state level. When you combine them, I think data that I looked up yesterday preparing to come on this program, that we take about 10% of the income of the average citizen. Virginia's like 9.7 and so forth. The average for the United States is 10% among the states. We rank 22nd among the states. There are another 28 in back of us in terms of that percentage. Maine is at the top. With 13%. I'm glad I just have a summer home there and don't live there.
Well, the other question to ask, it seems to me, is when you're making these comparisons, do rates like the unemployment rate and investment rate and economic growth really tell the whole story of how well people are doing? If you're unemployed in the United States or you're underemployed, if you can have a job in the United States and no health insurance, you're in rough shape. You can be unemployed in France and have some kind of coverage, you're in a little better shape. So is that difficult? That's the question. I mean, aren't there other things to compare services that are paid for by these high taxes in other countries that you simply don't get if you have a low-paying job in the United States?
Well, I don't know if that's true. I think most studies show that the poor people in the United States are actually better off than poor people in most countries around the world in terms of the stuff they have, cars, housing space, microwave ovens and VCRs and cable TV and all those kinds of what in most parts of the world are considered luxuries. So I question the premise, actually.
Mike Munger, if we do make the comparison and find out that the rest of the developed world, particularly in Europe, may or may not resent taxes the way we do, but for some reason allow them, it is not as politically difficult to get higher taxes. And apparently this is a cultural and political phenomenon there. What is it about the political history of the United States that makes us so resistant to this and gives us this powerful sense? It's ours and let us spend it. It'll turn out just fine.
Well, we often selected for people who came here for that reason. So the people who stayed in Europe may have been those that had a more collectivist or communitarian ethic. The people who came to the United States, except those that went to Buffalo, of course, were crazy people. They wanted to be off on their own, and there was a sense that they wanted to be able to keep what was their own. My first teaching job was at Dartmouth. It's right on the New Hampshire-Vermont border, and I knew a guy who worked at the university who kept two homes, one in Vermont and one in New Hampshire, and depending whether he was unemployed at the time, because sometimes he would just take time off from his work. If he was unemployed, his address was in Vermont because they had excellent benefits. If he was working, he was in New Hampshire because they had no income tax.
So that's a state-to-state comparison of how things go. When we have the debate in this country, it does seem to me that the fundamental debate is over what kind of civilization, what kind of society we want to build, and whether or not all of us have a responsibility to take care of people sort of at the bottom economically. And that is a question that's fair to ask, Roy Cordato.
Sure. But I don't like the question. We don't build society. It makes it sound like, what kind of society does the government want to now orchestrate? Well, that doesn't sound like a free society to me. That's what they did in the Soviet Union. What I want is a free society where the order of the society is determined by free people interacting through voluntary trade and exchange and any other kind of voluntary interaction. So Friedrich Hayek, Nobel Prize winner, talked about the concept of a spontaneous order, which is the kind of order that evolves organically as free people interact with each other. It is not, when that's what you're looking for, you do not start with the question, what kind of society do we want to have?
Those free people interact using an infrastructure that usually comes as part of public policy. We have we have an interstate highway system that is directly attributable to a centrally planned federal policy in how we use tax dollars, and it changed the way we consume oil, it changed the way we use space, it changes the way we have transportation and the way downtown's developed. So does it really operate in a vacuum? Do we all make free choices, or do we have to, aren't there infrastructure built in that then we all become beneficiaries.
It doesn't operate in a vacuum, but it does change the way you look at the role of government when you see society. For example, if you start with the premise, if you're Congress and you say, how do we want our society to look, then you're going to start manipulating the tax code to benefit this company and penalize that company to benefit this kind of behavior. We don't like people who smoke, therefore we're going to tax them, but we like people who, I don't know, eat organic food, so we're going to reduce the tax on them. We don't like people who drink soda, so we're going to increase the tax on them. It becomes using the tax code to orchestrate people's lives, which I find actually repulsive.
But Mike Munger, we have a political process that says we as individuals get together as a group and decide which sort of infrastructure, what kind of preferences we are going to build in, knowing that there's going to be this impact on how business is done, whether or not we have suburban sprawl or not, whether or not we use a lot of cars and oil or not.
Well, I think a lot of people want to have it both ways. And in principle, I agree with Roy, but I think there are some more complexities. Think for a minute. What's the biggest housing program in the United States? And the answer is the mortgage interest tax deduction. We spend $66 billion a year. That's more than twice all we spend on low income or any sort of housing assistance to the poor. So a lot of people who, like myself, think of themselves as being independent, low tax. The main thing that, well, in some ways I'm being subsidized. The fact that I live in a large house and get that mortgage interest deduction, I'm being subsidized by other people. Now, if we got rid of taxes altogether, the deduction wouldn't count as much. But the fact remains, the biggest program in the U.S. is subsidizing big houses.
And that allows people to go in and buy houses, get a piece of the rock, and really changes their economic outlook, what they can do, how much they can borrow, whether they can send their kids to college. So these are subtle effects, William Tournier, that the tax code has, if you're going to have one.
They do. Back on the topic, however, of, you know, government doing things versus private industry doing things, I think the real proper approach to this is to ask yourself, what does government do better and what do private enterprises do better? A government does a better job of roads, for example. I wouldn't want to have driven over from Chapel Hill and been stopped three times to have tolls collected from me. Public safety is something else that I think that we want. Fire, police, that use of force, the right for people to walk around the street and carry guns and cart people off to jail. And I think another thing, for example, is research, a lot of scientific research. I had a friend of mine work for a drug company out in the Research Triangle, and he was fond of saying, we don't want a cure, we just want a maintenance drug, all right? And, you know, a cure is no good for a drug company. Cure is good for the general public, all right? And on the other hand, there are things like producing consumer goods that there's no reason why government should be involved in that. Retailing, there's no reason why government should be involved in that. The problem is when you get to some place in the middle there, and that's where people start disagreeing.
Well, I think the middle shifts a little bit too. Roy Cordato, how do you feel about roads? You heard what William Tournier said, but the fact is toll roads are up for consideration. That is one other way to pay for highways, and one that the John Locke Foundation, I think, supports.
And they would not be as cumbersome. Nowadays, if anyone's taking a ride up the Northeast Corridor on 95, you can pay lots of tolls without not once stopping to pay for a toll. The Easy Pass system is quite now. I think tolls should be used primarily to control traffic flow. So, for example, I would be very much in favor of high occupancy toll lanes, which would allow people to deviate from high traffic areas, pay a toll to do that. But drive in
there you go. They got the government telling us where to drive.
Do anyway. They put the roads down, correct?
And public education. I mean, this is something again that we think. While there's a lot of talk about privatization, private schools, charter schools, is this something that's better done at the public level? Because again, if you're talking about wealth determining the quality of education, do we perpetuate wealth and then therefore perpetuate poverty if we don't have a good public education system where the costs are spread out across the whole economy?
Good is the key question there, isn't it? And what we have found is that the government school system really has failed a lot of people, and they're not my kids and they're probably not Mike's kids, but they're kids at the lowest end of the economic ladder. So the key word is good. And I think we've spent a lot of time and a lot of money going from good to not so good, actually.
Mike Munger, is there anything, as you look across the sort of scope and history of Americans and their taxes and public policy, that Americans have always been agreed on, that we all think that the government does better?
Politically, the pressure is always towards vote for me and I'll give you other people's money. So if I, as a politician, can find a way to make a program like that, I think that's a price we pay. We're willing to have government programs like that. Recently, we've been doing something that Russell Long had sort of a song about. Tax reform means don't tax me, tax that other fellow behind the tree. And what we're doing more and more is taxing future generations. It isn't really true that the Bush administration has cut taxes. The Bush administration has cut taxes on us. Our children and their children are going to bear the burden
because
of that.
We're borrowing so much.
We're borrowing so much from the future.
William Turnier, I think you had a good line when our question was, are we getting what we paid for? And you thought,
I think we're getting more than we pay for. 18% of the cost of running the federal government is being borrowed.
And those are just future taxes.
Yeah. Right.
Somebody's got to pay for that at some point. Well, we're talking today about taxes, government infrastructure, with Mike Munger of Duke University, William Turnier, who teaches tax law at UNC, and Roy Cordato from the John Locke Foundation in Raleigh. Just ahead, we'll take some calls and emails at 877-962-9862, SOT@WUNC.org, on the State of Things. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, talking today about the distribution of your tax dollars, who should decide where the money goes, and what the decisions will be made with your dough. With me in the studio, Mike Munger, an economist and chair of the Political Science Department at Duke. William Turnier is a professor of law who teaches tax law at the University of North Carolina Chapel Hill Law School. And Roy Cordato is the vice president for research and a resident scholar at the John Locke Foundation in Raleigh. Taking your calls at 877-962-9862. We'll go right to the phones. Van is on the line from Cary. Hi, Van.
Hi. I just wanted to make the comment. I was astounded that the two academics didn't stand up and respond when the gentleman from the John Locke Foundation mentioned Hayek's spontaneous economic organization. I mean, no one seriously believes that anymore, do they? I mean, anytime you see markets attempting to develop spontaneously, what you see is the exercise of power, not reasoned self-interest, not rational self-interest, which is what the underlying philosophical justification for a spontaneous economic organization is. People don't operate under reasonable, rational self-interest. They operate under power and what they can get. And I mean, look at Enron. Just look at all the different areas in which that rational self-interest, economicus, what is it, the economic man, just doesn't fly.
All right, well, let's get a response. Thank you, Van.
I think the comment I made about drug companies is a good example of that. It's not in the economic self-interest of a drug company to find you a silver bullet that's going to cure your problem right away. They'd rather have you on drugs, operating based on basic self-interest for the rest of your life, collecting $100 or $200 a month from you for the rest of your life. Whereas the reason why the government wants to get into this sort of stuff and promote certain types of research is to find the cure and save society a lot of money.
That said, and even at that, we find that in the United States, for instance, we have the so-called 10-90 split, where most of the money in research, even in the United States, goes to serve the 10% of the wealthiest folks in the world, 90% of the folks who have least amount of money to pay for the drugs that will be developed from that research. That research goes begging. So there are other than market mechanisms. Roy Cordato, is it true? Does the market becomes distorted as wealth begins to accumulate?
I find it interesting because clearly the biggest wielder of power in society is the state. I mean, the state is the only institution that can legally use force, physical force on people to extract their income. So, if someone's really concerned about power, it seems to me that the focus should be not on the market and contract and free exchange, but on the state, which is George Washington said it right. I mean, the state is force by definition.
William Turnier?
Well, I'd say one thing to keep in mind when you talk about the state is look at the way we run elections in this country and who. And some of the scandals that we've had going on in D.C. with the influence of people of money, the way we fund them, the more money you got, the more influence you're likely to have. And so consequently, the state is likely to start weighing in on the side of people with power. The state's power, but in back of that power tends to be a lot of accumulated wealth.
So clearly we see a system now where money buys power and power weighs in on the favor in the favor of people who have wealth already. That's the
just
system.
Just ask our House Speaker.
That's the system we've evolved. And there's no doubt about it that that's where we are. Mike Munger, you might doubt that, and I'd let you chime in. But then the question becomes, in a more pure system, does the state have a role to act as referee, to act as guardian against the accumulation of wealth, which by itself becomes a distortion within a market? It creates its own markets. Is that a fair observation, Mike Munger? At some point, if wealth accumulates to, it can come to the point where markets are distorted and don't work as freely as Adam Smith would have liked.
Here's the problem. Competition.
We don't want problems. We want solutions on
competition
this program,
is the enemy of profits. So the more competition we have, the less profits there will be. Corporations are out for profits, and self-interest may very well lead them to do things that harm the public interest. The problem is to make that clash of self-interest serve the public interest. But corporations, if they can make campaign contributions and if government meddles in the business of markets, it's obvious that what you're going to end up with is regulated markets. You're going to prevent competition and you're going to get profits as a result. So let's think about the drug company example. If I can invent something that will cure cancer, I can make a ton of money. Would it be better still if it was something someone had to take for the rest of their life? Yes. But if I can invent something that'll cure cancer, somebody else invents it first, they get the patent, I lose out. So the clash of self-interest, always, if it's allowed to work through competition, is going to make us all better off. Thinking, what would it be in my individual self-interest to be able to do? Sure, then you get Enron. If you get insulated markets, like our energy, whether our energy system, energy market, with no competition, hived off little markets, that's what caused Enron.
And it happens when concentration, when wealth becomes concentrated and industries become consolidated. If we stick with the pharmaceutical industry, fabulous story, one of several, a series in the Wall Street Journal that showed a pharmaceutical company that stopped research on a drug that would have prevented death from peanut allergies. There was one researcher who was really hot to do it, tried to get the money, couldn't, ended up working for a big drug company, made certain inroads, was on his way. Drug company said, you know, that's really not a line of research we're pursuing now. We're going to cancel that, and we're going to prohibit you from continuing your research because we got the dough and you don't, and now you can't pursue this line of research because they had accumulation of wealth. They could say, you're not in this business anymore.
I'm with you right up to the point where you say, and government will do better. There's no clash of self-interest there. There's just a bunch of guys with tanks.
But does the government play a role in regulating an industry like that once the accumulation
of wealth? Why don't you think
wealth...
the government acts in its self-interest? I understand thinking that corporations act in their self-interest. I think government acts in its self-interest, too, and there's no competition.
Is there a role for the public to play, to design some kind of public referee that says this market has become distorted and no longer serves the public interest? Is there a way to design that kind of a public
interest? We would all rather watch Survivor than an election debate.
Another market decision.
We get the government we deserve.
It is a democracy after all. Mike Munger, thank you very much. We're out of time. Economist and chair of the Political Science Department at Duke University. Thank you, Mike.
Thanks for having me.
William Turnure is a professor of law who teaches tax law at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill Law School. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Roy Cordato, vice president for research and resident scholar at the John Locke Foundation in Raleigh. Thanks very much.
Happy to be here.
Coming up, Raleigh activist Gail Ferris doesn't want her taxes going to support the former School of the Americas. Her story next on The State of Things. Stay with us.